introduce Bob, who will introduce our speaker today.
I'm very pleased to welcome to the podium today author and UW lecturer Sean Francis Peters. Dr. Peters completed his PhD at UW-Madison last year and has a BA from Rutgers 1988, MA from Iowa 1995. He has worked at the UW-Madison in a variety of capacities since 1998 and will be teaching in religious studies at UW-Oshkosh next year. In the past, he has taught in a variety of disciplines at universities in New Hampshire, Iowa, Wisconsin, and he did a bit of classwork in law in grad school, but describes himself as much more of a historian and journalist. He grew up in a Catholic family in Catonsville, Maryland, site of the Catonsville Nine draft protest in 1968, in which the Berrigan brothers and seven others seized and burned draft files. Watch for his next book on that topic. His most recent book is When Prayer Fails, Faith Healing, Children, and the Law, Oxford University Press, October 2007. Two earlier books are available from our South Central Library System, Judging Jehovah's Witnesses, Religious Persecution and the Dawn of the Rights Revolution, 2000, and The Yoder Case, Religious Freedom, Education, and Parental Rights, 2003, the book I mentioned last Sunday dealing with a dispute over application of compulsory education requirements to an Amish community in New Glarus, Wisconsin, which went to the U.S. Supreme Court. Today, we will hear him talking to us about religious convictions, reflections on faith, healing, children, and the law. Dr. Peters.
Thank you, Bob, for that generous introduction, and thank you all for inviting me here to share these ideas with you today. Earlier this week, I thought I might have to kind of paddle and portage my way over here because of the rain, but luckily I was able to just drive my Toyota this morning. As Bob mentioned, I'll be speaking on Faith Healing Children in the Law today. And unfortunately, it's a topic that is, it's been in the news quite a bit of late. There's been a prominent case of this in Wisconsin, in the town of Weston, which is north of here. It's near Wausau, in which an 11-year-old girl died on Easter Sunday after her parents chose to treat her diabetes strictly with prayer. Rather than seeking the medical treatment that almost certainly would have preserved her life, and that being diabetes. There's a case in Wisconsin. There are two cases going on that are very similar, unfortunately, in the state of Oregon. The facts and the law are kind of roughly the same. And so these are not simply things that some egghead historian cares about in some obscure way. They're actually in the news quite a bit. I thought maybe what I would do is briefly speak about religion and law broadly as a way to kind of lead up to the nuts and bolts of those cases to provide a little bit of a context and a framework for understanding Faith Healing Children and the Law a little bit more fully. I think it's probably important. Most discussions in religion and law begin with the First Amendment. The First Amendment, as you know, protects the right to the free exercise of religion. That doesn't mean you can do anything you want legally in the name of religion, just as there are limitations on speech, limitations on freedom of the press, there are limitations on religious conduct. And we can look for a second at sort of how those limitations have developed. It's worth noting, too, that these are issues that are actually a relatively recent vintage in American courts. There really isn't a significant religious liberty case heard by the United States Supreme Court until the 1870s. Once they get into the system, though, starting in the late 19th century, more of them happen and are heard by the courts, and standards sort of percolate through. One of these standards, and it's an important one to think about, is a distinction between religious beliefs and religious conduct. Oftentimes when I speak to people, they think that an important distinction legally is between sort of good religion and bad religion, or legitimate religion and illegitimate religion, and that good religion is protected and that bad religion is not protected. That actually seeps in some, and the courts do privilege certain kinds of religious practices over others. But generally, the first important distinction is between belief and conduct. And the idea is that belief is sacrosanct. Belief, your religious ideology, really can't be messed with by the state through coercion, through regulation. However, how you act on the basis of those beliefs can be regulated as it relates to the state's interest in controlling public order, maintaining safety, and just sort of doing the police stuff that the state does. In the courts, this plays out first in the case of, most significantly, in the case of polygamy, which as a historian, this has been kind of an interesting 6 months or so. Faith healing, polygamy, there are these religious liberty issues dating from the late 19th century that are still with us today, right? Warren Jeffs and the fundamentalist Latter-day Saints in Texas are in the news. Faith healing is in the news, which says something, I think, about how easy it is to sort of manage these kinds of issues through the implementation of public policy. It's actually very difficult to do. In the case of polygamy, Mormons claimed in the 1870s that plural marriage was a bona fide religious practice, and that as such should be protected by the First Amendment. They were freely exercised. To be able to freely exercise their religion, their practice of polygamy had to be protected. The Supreme Court was kind of skeptical of that claim. Sort of scoffed at the idea that it was a legitimate religious practice, and instead, marriage is a civil institution. The state can regulate it, and if the state wants to prohibit polygamy, it can. That is the first sort of meaningful Supreme Court decision in this area. Next come the Jehovah's Witnesses. Bob mentioned I could bore you for the next several hours talking about the Jehovah's Witnesses. I will not do that, fortunately. The Witnesses, during the 1930s and 40s, sort of the World War II era, the Witnesses are involved in this flood of litigation at all levels of the courts. Hundreds of lower court cases involving the Jehovah's Witnesses, 23 United States Supreme Court decisions involving the Jehovah's Witnesses between 1938 and 1946. So if they ever, you know, when you go to the coffee shop or the sub store and they give you that punch card for being a frequent user, the Jehovah's Witnesses would have filled up several of those little punch cards. They kept going to the Supreme Court over and over. The at issue were the Witnesses' religious practices, specifically two of them mainly, religious proselytizing. Going door to door, many of you I'm sure have experienced this, soliciting, selling copies of the Watchtower, distributing Bibles, distributing tracts. The Witnesses define that as worship in the way we're all doing this today. For them, the church is sort of, the street is sort of their church. That's one issue. The second issue was their refusal to salute the American flag on the grounds that it was a form of religious idolatry. Over time, many of the courts look at these cases over and over again. The proselytizing cases involve efforts to suppress witness proselytizing. Witnesses would sort of descend on small towns and annoy people. The town council would get together and say, what are we going to do with these witnesses? Let's ban religious proselytizing. There are lots of cases like that. In general, the courts said there's kind of a balance that needs to be struck. And that the state does have an interest in regulating stuff, but in this case, the witnesses' religious liberty is more significant. And so, not in every case in every jurisdiction, but in general, the witnesses win those cases. And so, there's this kind of evolution of a standard weighing on one hand an individual's religious practice and the need to protect that kind of religious practice, which we think is important and is codified in the First Amendment, but also respecting the state's duty to exercise its police power. Now, Bob also mentioned, this is my kind of thing, so I've written books about this stuff. The next really significant case involves the Old Order Amish in New Glarus, just down the road in Greene County. Starting in 1968, there's a case involving the enforcement of the state's compulsory attendance law. It says that you need to go to school until you're 16. The Old Order Amish believe in formal education only up until the age of 14. They think that anything beyond that would be kind of corrupting and that their kids will become sort of too worldly and that it will threaten their religious community. Those extra 2 years would be a threat. Supreme Court sided with the Amish in that case, and really that's the high watermark for judicial protection for religious liberty. That's the most protection. It's a very expansive ruling that gives religious practices their most sort of substantive protection from the courts. After that, there's kind of diminution of these protections. It becomes easier for states to regulate religious conduct. There's this thing called the rational basis test, which seems kind of a misnomer to me when we're talking about state regulation. But famously, in the case of the ceremonial use of peyote by Native Americans, the Supreme Court said that the state of Oregon could, even though Native Americans had a long tradition sort of predating the white settlement of the state of Oregon, using peyote for religious purposes, that in fact could be regulated. What happens generally is the courts are generally reluctant to allow the policing of religious conduct. It's a very sensitive area. They sort of bend over backwards to protect individuals who are engaged in worshiping or any of the activities that might sort of be associated with religious worship or religious practice. It's a sensitive area, and these cases generally leave people with a bad taste in their mouths. The individuals who are prosecuted feel like they're being persecuted for their religious beliefs. Prosecutors politically don't tend to really get much traction or benefit from hauling Amish into court, right? They're very sympathetic defendants. And so law enforcement is wary of getting involved in these cases. Now, that brings me back to faith healing in the law. In the United States, there have been legal cases involving faith healing basically dating from the late 19th century. In England, somewhat earlier than that, maybe the 1840s and the 1850s. These cases typically don't involve adults. Generally, the courts have said, if you're a competent adult, you're free to sort of make your own medical decisions. Pregnant women are a different, more complicated class, and I would exclude them from that sweeping generalization. But generally, the courts have said, you can do what you want to yourself if you're competent. Children are another matter entirely. We see in the 19th century the development of protections for the rights of children. And also for the recognition that the state can have a duty to intervene between parents and their children. If parents are engaging in behavior that might be harmful to children, the state's job is to step in and to protect the child. In that framework, cases involving the attempted prosecution of parents for failing to provide medical treatment for their children begin to emerge. And the question is, specifically, and this is a question that really hasn't changed since maybe 1880 or 1890, do parents have a specific legal duty to provide medical treatment to their children, even when the doctrines of their religious faiths prohibit the use of medicine and mandate prayer instead? That is the question. And the short answer is, yes. They do have a legal duty. If you go back to that balancing test that I was talking about, on one hand, You have religious healing traditions. They've been around for a long time. Certainly in the Christian scriptures, you can look at many Christian faiths have engaged in some variety or another of religious healing practices, and not only Christians, many other faiths. It is a, in general, it is a religious practice. So the parents do have an interest. But here we have the state's interest, and the state's interest is really paramount, right? It's protecting life. It might be the most important thing that the state does. And so when you balance those two things, more or less the state wins. The state's interest in preserving life is more important as a legal matter than protecting individuals in this particular legal practice. So you would think that it's a pretty easy legal issue, right, based on what I've just described to you. But it is not. It's complicated because most states have specific provisions in their child abuse code that specifically exempt parents from prosecution when they substitute prayer for medicine. Wisconsin is one of more than 30 states that has a very direct, clear exemption for that kind of conduct. I won't get into the genesis of where these things, where these provisions came from, except to say that in the mid-1970s, there was a federal mandate that came down to states that they, if they wanted to receive ongoing federal funding from what was then the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, they needed to have provisions like this in their codes. The federal government eventually realized that that represented an establishment clause issue, and eventually that mandate was rescinded in 1983, but the states had already changed their laws and didn't remove these exemptions. The exemptions kind of lurk in the code. People don't really pay attention to them until they complicate prosecutions of parents who engage in faith healing in lieu of providing medical treatment. Which brings me to the Karen Newman case here in Wisconsin. I won't get too far into the details of her death, except to say that she essentially died from diabetes, and everyone who I know who has looked at the medical evidence in the case has said that a regimen of insulin would have preserved her life. Her parents have been charged with second-degree reckless homicide, and that's kind of our version of manslaughter here in Wisconsin. They haven't been charged under Wisconsin's child abuse law. They can't really be charged under Wisconsin's child abuse law because of this religious healing exemption that can apply specifically to parents who engage in faith healing. Needless to say, the legal issues in this case will be complex. I think potentially, if the parents are convicted and there is an appeal, there will be a matter of kind of conflicting interpretations of the law. On one hand, the child abuse law says to parents, you can engage in faith healing and not take your child to a doctor. On the other hand, the district attorney in Marathon County has applied the second-degree reckless homicide statute and said, wait a minute, this conduct is not protected by the law. She's trying to do an end run around that religious healing exemption. Now, this is what's known as a due process of law issue. The parents, if they are convicted, I am sure, will say, this is too confusing. My right to due process of law has been violated because we have two kind of mutually exclusive things going on. On one hand, the child abuse law says I could be a faith healer, but on the other hand, the prosecutor in Marathon County has said, I can't. What to believe? This isn't a very sexy argument. The parents' attorneys in this case, I've heard them speak publicly, and they seem to want to make a straight kind of First Amendment argument that this is religion. You can't prosecute people for engaging in religious behavior. That'll never work. It sounds really good, and I think that it has kind of visceral appeal. This kind of boring due process of law issue is actually much more... will be much more effective. There have been other cases in other jurisdictions where it has actually worked. Parents have had their convictions overturned on the basis of this due process claim. The solution is to just remove the exemption from the code. That's the way you get around that problem. And in fact, in those other cases, the courts have said, we wish we could uphold these convictions, but we can't. The legislature needs to take action. It's not the business of the courts to do that. As the Newman cases unfolded, and also these analogous cases in Oregon have unfolded, I've been kind of bombarded with questions from people. And the most frequent one, and it's really, I think, the most profound and a significant question really is, how could the parents have done this? How could they have denied the treatment to their child that almost certainly would have saved that child's life? And I'm not going to stand up and kind of defend their conduct. I mentioned to a few people before we got started today, I have two children, one of whom is three, one of whom is seven. We worship at the Church of Dean Care, our HMO. It's where we go for this kind of thing. So my worldview is completely different than the worldview of these parents. But as someone who's written, I've written and looked at hundreds of these cases, I've really, really tried to kind of step back and see where they're coming from. Not to defend, but to just kind of comprehend. And what I can say is that the parents believed they were doing what was best for their child. We can look at it now and say they erred grievously and that they should have known better. In terms of their worldview, they did what they thought was right. They did not honestly think that treating their daughter with medicine would work. It's never the case in these sorts of deaths where the parents just sort of concoct a crazy, they mess up and they concoct a crazy excuse and say, I'll just say I'm a faith healer. I know the medicine would work, but I'll just to get away with it, I will say that we believe this. They really sincerely did not believe that medicine, as outlandish as that might sound to us, they didn't believe that medicine would work. And further, they believed that medical treatment was not in accordance with the Word of God, specifically the Epistle of James. There's a passage in James that seems to mandate prayer and anointment with oil for the treatment of disease rather than the use of physicians. I'm also asked, the second question is, what do I think should happen legally in these cases? And I have to be honest, I'm really ambivalent about this problem being resolved in the courts. The courts are really a horrible place to resolve complex social and cultural problems. Case study number one is the drug problem, right? The enforcing drug laws, incarcerating people, really hasn't done very much to solve that issue. And further, as I was driving over here, I was trying to think of a successful instance of state regulation of religious behavior in the United States where the state has said, you can't, we're going to enforce a law and stop you from doing this. And it really doesn't work very well. Polygamy is the classic example. 1878 was the year that the Supreme Court said that polygamy could be banned. And still today, it's ongoing. And what's worse is that it gets kind of driven underground away from scrutiny. And in fact, revamped laws and really aggressive prosecutions under them don't necessarily work to protect children who are imperiled by these kinds of practices. Oregon is an example of this. About 8 years ago, Oregon changed its laws to make it easier to prosecute parents in these kinds of circumstances. They had one of these exemptions. They removed the exemption, and everyone thought, aha, this will be great. Parents will be deterred now from engaging in this kind of conduct because they know that they're going to go to jail. This will stop them. Lo and behold, we've had a couple of reported deaths, the deaths we know about, and my sense is that there have been other deaths that we haven't known about. The enforcement of these laws as a deterrent is not necessarily very effective. Devout individuals do not always fear temporal earthly punishment. The punishment and the judgment that they are concerned with is not going to happen here. It's going to happen in the hereafter. And we've seen cases where parents have lost multiple children. They'll lose a child, they'll be prosecuted, they'll get probation or go to jail, they'll get out of jail, and they'll say, my beliefs really are unshaken by this experience. My child's death, really, it was God's will, and I'm going to keep doing what I do in terms of my faith. People like me, academics like to show up and pontificate and say that we have the answers. Right, if everybody just listened to me, the world would be a better place, and I'm the expert, and I know. I guess I'm older now, and I'm really reluctant to do that, and I won't. I will say, and as I kind of wrap up, I'm really struck by the lack of dialogue and the lack of conversation on this topic. You have faith healers, child welfare advocates, prosecutors, legislators, medical ethicists, all of whom speak about this topic but don't necessarily speak to one another in a meaningful, productive way. I think we might do better outside the context of law enforcement to bring those people together somehow and to have a discussion that's really grounded on the thing that unites all of them, and that is a concern for the welfare of children. Thanks. And I can...